Their eyes were opened still wider, and they learned a new lesson. They returned, and as if entering a new level of feeling, they could truly accept AA's teachings. That's kind of my story. That's really the story that I'm up here to talk about this morning. Because a lot of things happen to alcoholics, and some of the things that have happened to me that I suppose I'd like to talk about. I got thrown out of the Marine Corps after a career of 14 years, a regular officer. I went through a divorce after 18 years of marriage and had to walk out of a home and six children. And I married again, and it ended in a separation. And I went through bankruptcy. And I went from job to job trying to find something that I could really get a handle on. And I had one of my sons come up to me and say, "Gee, I wish you had been around more when I was growing up." And the reason I bring all these things up is that they've all happened since I came into AA. And they've all happened since I had my last drink. And I have to think about those things. And I have to wonder about them. And it causes me to wonder, what did I do wrong? This is some of the thoughts that entered my mind. What did I do wrong? And I found a tremendous problem in forgiving myself. And I found a tremendous problem in understanding this. I found a tremendous problem of what is going on here? And I realized that I was that person in that Bill had written about. I was exactly that person who came and got so excited about AA and went to a meeting every night and 12-stepped and just charged in and lost balance in my life. I was gone 7 nights a week. I just was so involved and so carried away with sobriety and not drinking. And it was exciting. And I got into the steps. And I went through the steps. I found them a wonderful intellectual exercise. And I looked at them and they were exciting to me. And they had a lot of thought-provoking words in them. I realize now that I, for a good number of years, I would say 6 or 7 years, almost took them, came close, took some of them, but skirted getting down to in depth, especially in steps 4 and 5 and 10 and 11. And I want to talk about the steps, and I have to talk a little bit about my background. I have to talk about the kind of person that I am. I come from New England. I was brought up a Catholic, and I acquired a wonderful relationship with guilt as a little boy. I had that. You know, I'd been sober. I brought another piece of paper to read, because I remember after I'd been sober about 5 years, I was trying to understand guilt. And if you know the pamphlet, The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, the author, McGinnis, talks about guilt being one of the first character defects that we get, and very often the last to go. And with me, it was after 8 years of sobriety that it finally went. Because I want to tell you the kind of guilt I'm talking about. I had to sit down one time and write it out so that I could remember it and understand what I meant by my guilt. And this is what I wrote a long time ago. I said, "I must have done something wrong before I was born." To upset God, or He wouldn't have forced me to be born. I felt very guilty about whatever I did, and I feel very guilty about feeling guilty. I feel guilty about the things I'm going to do in the future. My birth itself makes me feel guilty. Somehow I should have been able to spare my mother the pains of childbirth. I felt guilty about not fulfilling the potential that my parents and teachers said that I had. I felt guilty about having the potential. And guilty about not knowing what it was for. I felt guilty for not having the courage to do certain wrong things that other people enjoy doing. And then I could feel some real guilt. I feel guilty because I am always doing things that God doesn't want me to do. And that is because I don't know what God does want me to do, which makes me feel guilty about not knowing what God wants me to do. Therefore, I feel guilty about having done whatever caused God not to let me know what He wants me to do. As a result, I feel guilty that this can never be changed unless God lets it be changed, and He won't until I stop feeling guilty, which causes me to feel guilty about feeling guilty. But I feel guilty about wanting to get rid of this guilt because I know that I'm supposed to have this guilt. Because I'm supposed to have this guilt because, you see, I really am guilty. Guilty of what, you ask? Why, guilty of all the things that make me feel guilty. Why the hell do you ask? And I'll tell you, that's a problem. That's a funny paper. That's a very funny paper. But it's not a funny problem. It's not a funny problem. I felt like another sentence that came out of Bill W. I felt as I was going along in AA, and I relate somehow to this. This was, they were describing Bill W. Not that I'm comparing myself to Bill W., but I'm comparing this to a problem. It said no matter how he saw himself, it did seem a paradox that he, through the steps, through his writing and talking, had been a channel through which others had found the truth that he was still seeking. That others had passed him by and had found things that he was still seeking through answers that he had. And it was like having the answers, but not getting there. And I have come to understand over the last 5 years that what I had were the directions. And the 12 steps really were the way. There's no doubt that the 12 steps were the way. Just like I can know the way from here to Atlanta. Go down a certain road, you make a left, you make a right, you go here and you go there. But until I travel the way, I will still be here. Even though I know the way very well and know exactly how to get there, until I get on the road and go, I will never get to Atlanta or wherever I want to get. And it took me a while. I'm a book fanatic. I'm a great book fanatic. Mine's the 12 and 12. Some people have their big book marked and cross-references and so on down. I don't know why, but now I have my 12 and 12. It's the same way. And I found that it's the 12 steps as presented in that particular volume that have enabled me to deal with Tom talked about last night, untreated alcoholism. I had stopped drinking, but I had not dealt with the untreated alcoholism. I had not dealt with what the big book talks about, the causes of my alcoholism. I had stopped drinking, but I hadn't dealt with the problems that were there. I hadn't dealt with guilt. I hadn't dealt with all my upbringing as a little kid. I hadn't dealt with the fact that I felt superior or inferior even when I did better than someone else. I didn't understand potential. I talked to the kid about my potential. That was my excuse to keep on drinking. I could always tell people, one of these days I'll unleash my potential and that'll show all those people that are looking at me as I would be lying. I think that explains why an alcoholic can be lying flat on his back and feel superior to the people looking down at him in the street. Because he says to himself, what do they know? One of these days I'm going to get up and I'm going to unload my potential on these people. And I'm going to get even with them and I'm going to show them and I'll show the world. And I'm really this. And we sit there with this strange combination of an inferiority complex and a tremendous amount of pride. knowing that we're special, and it's essential that I remain special. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous won't work for special people. It only works for routine drunks. That's the only people it works for. You have to be a routine drunk in order for the program to work. And how can you be routine when you have all this potential? How, when you come from New England and you're up in, you know, New England sits up in the upper right-hand part of the country and looks down intellectually on the rest of the country. I didn't know if you knew that. And my parents brought me up to be a snob, and I was to attend little private schools and go to Yale, and I went from Yale to jail, you know. That was the big cross spectrum of that, and so I knew what it was supposed to be, but then I knew what was inside, and it was different, and I was always comparing my inside with your outside, and there was a tremendous difference, and there was no sharing. There was no sharing growing up. You know how the world is. This is a very dog-eat-dog world, very competitive world. Don't show any signs of weakness, or they'll get you. And you remember how those wonderful Western movies and those heroes, and I'm talking about my upbringing now, just to show you where my mind was coming from. I thought it was essential that every man do it for himself, that to ask for help was a sign of weakness. And in those wonderful Westerns where the hero lived out in the desert, and whenever the people in the town got in trouble, they would send someone out to get him, and he would come in and go into the bar, have a couple of drinks, and say, "Where's the trouble? That guy over there, he's terrorizing the whole town." Walk over, "I understand you're terrorizing the whole town." Bam! And then he'd get on his horse, ride back out in the desert. And the townspeople would bow down and say, "Now there goes a real man." And I'd say, "Now there goes a real man, a real man, a real man." And I wasn't until I was around 35 years old I realized how weird it is to live alone in the desert with a horse. And only... and only come into town to kill people and then go back up. But that was important to me, that you had to do that. And then it was important that people not find out there's anything wrong with you. So before I even had my first drink, I was telling the perpetual alcoholic lie, and that is, "I'm fine, I'm fine." I wasn't fine. I was confused about life. I was confused about being guilty. I was confused about sins. I was confused about... God, I lived in a neighborhood of where there was a tremendous amount of impure thoughts, and they kept sneaking into my head, and it was causing me years in purgatory. They just kept creeping in there. And I say, "Would you get out of here? I don't want to have those things in there. I don't want these sins stacking up inside of me, because I'm going to have to come to judgment." And I was terrified about judgment. I had a horrible fear of death. My fear of death lasted until about 5 years ago, and I realized what a fear of death is. The only reason that I had a fear of death is that I had never lived, and that I was going to die without having lived. And that's why I had a fear of death. And as soon as I started living, who cares about it? It went away. It disappeared. It was irrelevant anymore. That's the real fear. The fear that you're going to say, "Hey, I went through all life and I never lived. All I did was feel. All I did was react. I never acted. I never thought my way through anything. I never learned who I was." Self-knowledge is the greatest trip in the world. And my only self-knowledge came from other people. If they patted me on the head, I got some approval. That meant I was all right. If they said, "You're not doing too good," I was rejected. That meant I was not all right. My total identity was dependent on you. I don't mean you, but on everybody, on everyone else. I had no concept. I had no relations. I had no set of values between me and a higher power, between me and other people. I didn't have any opinion of myself. It was totally dependent on, "Oh, well, people think about me." And I had to make them like me in order for me to like me. That's a setup. That's a sucker's game. That's a loser's game. That's an alcoholic's game. And I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. I lived in a very hostile world, a very cruel world, as I saw it. People were always, this was a competitive thing, as I say, and people were out to get each other. It was a free enterprise system. That's the American system. That's the way I saw it. You got to realize now, that may not have been what was told to me. That's what I heard. Then there's a great deal of difference between what's said and what's heard very often. And we know that. That's why the books were written, so they could, as Tom was talking about, we don't get the message screwed up. And so I had this. This was my vice. I felt I was not equal to anybody, and I would stand around on the street, and if somebody walked up, they could say, "Hey, you're in my spot." And I would say, "Sorry," and I'd move out of the way, because I knew that they must be right because I knew secretly inside I was wrong and I was only pretending that everything was all right. I was terrified someday that somebody was going to be able to see into my eyes that there was nothing there. And this terror grew and grew even before I had a drink. So I had a lot of problems before I started drinking. As you can see, we had certain problems. And those problems didn't go away when I stopped drinking. They just were still there. And I made the assumption, an assumption's a bad word. Anybody's been in the military knows we have some funny words that we say about assumption. But I made the assumption that they would go away when I stopped drinking, and they don't. I think character defects are like perpetual motion. They go on forever unless we fix them. It's just, if you get upset in traffic at age 40 and you don't do anything about it, you'll be getting upset in traffic at age 90 if you live that long. It'll be that simple. It won't go away by itself. You have to fix that, and you have to concentrate on it, and you have to work the steps on it, I think. So this is just my own opinion. Now, when alcohol came along in my life, it did one thing. I don't ever remember alcohol changing me at all. I had no feeling of going through my body at all. But boy, do I remember alcohol changing the people in the room where I was standing. I drank the alcohol, and those people became friendly. I drank the alcohol, and the world was no longer hostile. The world was no longer hostile. The world was pure Christianity. The world was now brotherly love. The world was as I dreamed about it. The world was just the way I read about it, but never experienced it. And it became essential for me, in order to be comfortable, that I change the world that I live in. I had to come out of my isolation and get into a comfortable world, and when I poured alcohol in my system, the world changed. And I decided I wanted to live in that world all the time. I didn't understand why we just didn't drink at our desks, at our offices, and then we could all be happy and be in this marvelous world, and I wanted to stay there. And so that was my drinking. I'm a primary alcoholic, which means that I drank socially for 10 or 15 minutes, crossed the line, and went into the, uncontrolled drinking. And I threw up and had a horrible day. It was just a terrible day, the first day that I drank. And little did I know that was going to be my best day drinking. And from there on, it was downhill all the way. And somehow I got through school. I don't remember graduating. I put my hand up one day. I joined the Marine Corps and followed a bunch of guys. I was a natural-born follower and went charging down and signed up for the Marine Corps. And I ran around out in the woods and didn't like that. So a movie about airplanes. So I signed up and I became a jet pilot, and that's where I spent all my time drinking, was as a pilot. And it's very exciting flying around the airplanes. Oh boy, isn't this fun, a big scarf and all this. Oh, now, you see, that made me feel more important. That made me, gee whiz, these guys are glamorous, these guys. But the funny thing is, as soon as I got there, it wasn't glamorous anymore. I don't know if that ever happened to you. If you graduate from college, that's a big deal until you do it. And then it's not a big deal, because if I can do it, it isn't a big deal. That was proof that it's not a big deal. Whatever there exists, if I can accomplish it, I've lowered it. You see what I'm talking about? Whatever it was. And so, I can remember as a little kid, and I had an uncle who was a captain and a pilot. When I became a captain and a pilot, suddenly that wasn't a big deal anymore, and I thought less of my uncle. So I want to show you what self-centeredness can do. That is self-centeredness. That is how you can, oh my God, that is the sickness. And it's so difficult to see. It's so difficult to get a handle on something like that. It is very deceptive. Alcoholism is so cunning and baffling. It is absolutely incredible. I drank around the Marine Corps for, 10 or 12 years and got grounded from flying and became an air traffic controller. And I did that for a year, and I'm very grateful I didn't kill anybody. And that was the end of my career, and I ended up in the nut ward in Bethesda Naval Hospital, and I was locked up for 5 months, DTs, I had malnutrition, and all the things. I ended up in a little bed, and actually it was a crib. And it had the sides on it, and I do want to talk about the steps, but I got to tell you that one story about being in that nut ward. God, that was awful. That's the first time I'd ever gone without booze in years and years and years. And now I've been sober 3 or 4 days, and you know how you're hurt, and it's just aching, and somebody had wet the bed I was in, and that whole thing. And there was this, awful hurting and aching, and we were locked up. And when you first go in there, you go in the room where there's no doorknobs, no sharp objects, bars on the windows. And there was three of us in a little circle over here in three little cribs. And there was a Navy commander on the other side of the room all by himself. And they would, corpsmen would come in about every 4 or 5 hours, bring a meal. And when they came in, then you could get a match and light your cigarette. And until then, you were in trouble. So the three of us had to keep a cigarette going like 24 hours a day. You know, and pass it to the other guy, and then go out, and then you'd wake up, and you'd get your cigarette going. You know, you might want to hand it over there. But this Navy commander over here in his crib by himself, he couldn't do that because he couldn't share. And he would pass out, and his cigarette would fall on the floor or on his mattress, whatever the hell, and it would be out. And now he had to sit over there with no cigarette until the corpsman came in. Sometimes he'd be in agony for 2 or 3 hours. And I remember sitting in my crib, looking over at this guy in his crib, and I was saying to myself, now there's a guy whose life is unmanageable. There's a guy with a problem. The son of a gun does, he can't even keep his cigarette lit. You know what I'm talking about? If I ever get that bad, I'll do something about that. And there we are. If I ever get that bad, I'll do something about it. If I ever get that bad. Anyway, I was marched into an AA meeting in the mental institution. All you drunks fall in right back when I was at the meeting. Now, I didn't like it. I resented being in the meeting. And 5 months later, after I was released, I did drink for 2 or 3 more days. And my alcoholism, I mean, it just hit like a ton of bricks. And I dialed operator, and a huge guy showed up, and he was my sponsor, and he was another Marine. And he came in, he said, hello, my name is Bill, this is a 12-step call, I talk, you listen. It was one of those basic relationships that's established right off the bat. As he said, listen, if you drink, I'm going to really be mad. And he was big, and I've had my teeth knocked out so many times. And here I am, a Marine with an 0-10 fight record. And it's very embarrassing, I apologize, but and this guy was so big, I stayed sober out of fear of sponsor. I said, Jesus, you know, I got to get rid of this guy. And so I was a temporary member of AA. I was just coming here to the meetings. I was shaking, tremble. I shook for 6 months. 6 months sobriety. I stand back by the coffee pot waiting for everybody to go away so I could get my half a cup and carry it up with both hands. Bring it up to the table, and then during the discussion, when I would look around and nobody was looking, I'd try to get that damn coffee up. I said, when are the shakes going to go away? You know, why me? You know, same old thing. Why me? And I had a lot of those things. One of my favorite was, but you don't understand. Now I work with new people, and I'm like, geez, whiz, what a universal statement. But you don't understand. I have all these things. And so I came into AA, and I was very excited about it. And I did not drink. And that, of course, is the essence of it. There's no way to stay alive without not drinking. Not drinking, I mean, what can you say in case there's somebody brand new here? Not drinking is like breathing. You have to not drink in order to have a chance at life. Just as much as you have to breathe in order to stay alive. But I say to you that if all there was to living was breathing, I might choose to quit. If I just sat in a room 24 hours a day and listened to myself breathe, I might just say, that's it, man, I'm turning it in. So there has to be more to sobriety than just not drinking. And there's a lot more. And there was barriers to getting there. And those were within me. And it's those barriers that I want to talk about, because maybe somebody else is going through some of these things. You know, they talk about the spiritual awakening. Bill Wilson's spiritual awakening was one of those sudden, dramatic flashes where things happened to him that in other people it takes years to happen. The changes, the revolutionary internal changes that just take place so suddenly. And they talk about in the back of the Big Book the different variety of spiritual awakenings and the more common kind, the educational type, as is discussed there, take place more gradually, or it takes time, and they come about a little bit at a time, and we can recognize them in retrospect, and very often other people can see them. And this is the type of growth that I think I was experiencing, only I thought I really had it sooner than I did. I thought I had finished a lot of the work before it was really had been started. It's possible to get that feeling. It's possible to get so enthusiastic about some of these things that we take some shortcuts. And I want to share some of those shortcuts as I learned about them out of the 12 and 12. I did stay sober, and I had a lot of fun, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I met a lot of wonderful people. But I didn't follow one of those slogans. I would have to say that I have a slogan where Tom and I might part company. My favorite slogan is think now. Out of the five, action is the key word, but I have to think. I had to learn how to think for myself. I found that I could not have relationships with other people. Even in AA, I found myself having two kinds of relationships. Either I was going to depend on the person, or I was going to be in charge. I have little did I understand of live and let live. I have find that one of the most difficult slogans to get a handle on yet. Either I had the answers or I was going to depend on somebody else. I had to return and come home when I was upset, and I would be dependent upon my wife to calm me down emotionally. I had no other way. How do I solve an emotional upset? Please fix me. It's your job to fix me. You're supposed to calm me down and solve my emotional problems. I am dependent totally on you, and so on down. And of course, whenever we're dependent on other people, they're just human. They're always going to let us down. They can't. So they're not perfect. They got their own problems. And of course, I can't solve other people's problems. I can't solve your emotional problems. That's your job. And I didn't understand. And what I think I missed was that these problems are all solved spiritually. I didn't realize all these problems have to be, everything in AA has to be solved spiritually, which means it has to be solved through a higher power. And I had a God that was a punishing one. I had a God that was a very terrifying thing. I'll never forget the first time I read the third step. It said something about turning my life over to the care of God, and I called my sponsor at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, listen, would you mind opening up your book there where it says turn your life over? I want to ask you one question. I know I'm bothering you late at night, but this is important. You know where it says a God there in the third step? By any chance, that's not the God, is it? I mean, yeah. The one in charge of purgatory and hell, and the guys waiting for me all those years. I mean, are you talking about that God? And he's on the other end of the line. He's laughing. He's laughing like hell. He says, well, I'll talk to you in the morning. We'll get together. And so he got there and he says, I understand your problem, Sandy. He says, you got to understand God totally before you're willing to make any progress in that area. He says, you're damn right I do. I'm not moving in there. I want to see the contract before I sign it. I want to, what the hell, man? This could be dangerous getting involved in something like this. And fear was there. There's a tremendous fear. And he was a great help initially. The help paid off initially, and then later on it really came into fruition about 5 years ago when he suggested to me that in my case, we had an emergency. We had a serious emergency, and that maybe what I really ought to do is to turn my life over to anything that would take it. And later on, we were trying to figure out what that was, what that particular quality was, because with my intellectual stubbornness, with my self-centeredness, I was liable to spend 15 or 20 years figuring out exactly who God was before I made a beginning on that step. And he said that if I was willing to do that, that we would have a miracle. And I said, oh, good, well, miracles, now that'll help me along. He said, well, what is the miracle? He says, the miracle is that the management of your life will no longer be in the hands of an idiot. And that,